The Future Proof Podcast from News Talk.
Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland. Hashtag believe in science.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof, the podcast. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. I'm Jonathan McRae. If you'd like to get in touch with the show, you can email us, science@newstalk.com, or you can find us on Twitter. We're at @NewstalkScience. We get to all of those later on in the podcast. Coming up on this week's episode, we'll be speaking to a guy called Skylar Tibbetts, who is working in MIT, developing new materials that can self-assemble. Some of the stuff is really amazing. You can see pictures of it on our Twitter page, @NewsTalkScience. But first, though, it's time to look back at the week's science news. And joining me via Skype is Dr. Shane Bergen from UCD, and from DCU, the Palindromic University, Dr. Susan Kelleher. How are you both?
Good. It is grading release day today. So students are getting their results, and I wish them all the very best. It's been quite the year for university students.
Do you give them just good results if you like them?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Anyone that kind of looks like a younger version of yourself is guaranteed to do well. Susan?
That's what I would do. Who would be any the wiser?
Fortunately, there are
external examiners. There...
Go on, ruining everyone's
Sorry.
Fun. Yeah. All right, fine. Okay, our first story, Shane.
No, man. No, man, tell you. That's what I love about these high school girls, man. I get older, they stay the same age.
Yes, they do.
Yes, they do.
Has to do with aging.
Yeah, and when you work in a university, you certainly notice this, because every year the students are the same age, but I'm not. this story is, it's quite a cool story, right? So we all know that life expectancies are going up in developed countries. In every country, actually.
In Ireland, Shane, in 1900 was 40-something. Now, obviously, some people lived to, I think it was 46. Obviously, some people would still, even in 1900, live to 80. But the life expectancy was 46. In 1950, it was 64. And now it's something like nearly 80, if not higher than 80. It's mad.
I know. And this story is interesting because it's about statistics, right? And so when you say it was 40 something in 1900, that's because an awful lot of people died as children or died young. So it brings down the average. But of course, if you weren't, plagued by bad health in your youth, you could live until roughly the same age that old people live to now. So what this study has shown is that what really controls your longevity is biological factors, and that environmental factors are ultimately not that big a deal. So they set to test this hypothesis called invariant rate of aging. And that says that for any species, there's a relatively fixed rate of aging from the onset of adulthood. And they found that it's exactly the same for humans as it is for other species. And so what public health has done is reduce the likelihood of us dying young, but it hasn't really allowed us to live longer. So we're not slowing down age. We're just not getting sick, or we're curing illness at younger ages.
Which
is quite cool. I mean, this is an enormous study from 14 countries led by Oxford. And I suppose it's a little controversial because the youth industry is currently worth $100 billion. And that's companies, academics, et cetera, that are all trying to, understand how can we slow down aging and have us live longer. Well, it turns out there may be a biological reason or biological limit to that, and that, we're going to age more or less at the same rate anyway. So all we could do is to help us get better when we get sick.
Well, there's a guy knocking around who's been talking about curing aging for quite some time, sort of an interesting character called Aubrey de Grey. And he was one of the first people we interviewed on this program. And he was saying, we're adding 10 years of life on every year. And so there's probably someone born today who will live to 150, because in the 10 years they're alive, they'll get an extra year and so on and so on. And that was his idea, that you could actually cure aging, and that it is, theoretically possible that in 50 years we'll have the first people who live forever, because we'll have cured all the things that make them ill and old. But you say that's unlikely.
Yeah,
It does seem
well,
unlikely.
it's not me that says it. It's scientists in 14 countries that have had their work published, and they compared birth and death data from humans and non-human primates and found the general pattern of mortality is the same in all species. So there could be a biological reason for this. There's also the broader issue of whether we should be living to 150, because there's a finite amount of resources on the earth, and we're having children at more or less the same rate. So is there enough room for us all? Like, is it ethical for us to live to 150? I suppose the good thing is that what we're doing is living longer, and we are living well into our old age. And ultimately, that's what it's about. It's that, like, you want to live to 90 or 100, and you want to be able to live as well as possible for all of those years.
Yeah.
And that's what science is really trying to help with, and medics are doing to implement.
Our second story, Susan, is a really interesting one looking at fear.
Yes. And this is a microbiome story, which makes it even more interesting because it really shows to me the evolution of scientific understanding and discovery. Because think back to when I was growing up, we didn't know anything about our microbiome, and we certainly didn't know it was important. So
I had a gut
now,
feeling.
Very good, Jonathan. We now know, as you know, that it plays a role in loads of things like brain and heart development and development of a strong immune system, and then even in weight gain, which we know is a really important thing we need to mind. So this research that came out this week was published in Nature Communications, and it looks at understanding the role that the microbiome plays in how young children perceive fear, and perceive threats. So what they did was they studied the microbiomes of 30 children at 1 month old, by sampling their stool, which makes me think there was a lot of nappies involved. They saw that then at 1 year old, they got the same children back, and they studied the reaction that the children had to someone entering a room wearing a Halloween mask.
Oh my God.
Yeah. Now, again, there were, this was sort of just to see if they were threatened by it. And they showed that the less diverse the microbiome was, it correlated to a number of things. So the first was that children with a less diverse microbiome, when they were 1 month old, were more fearful of the person in the mask at age 1 year. So then they also saw that the children with certain microbes in their microbiome at 1 year old were less fearful than others, indicating that not only is it about sort of where you were, but in terms of how your microbiome develops and the content of it, and that plays a role as well. They saw no connection between the difference in the microbiome and the fear of strangers. So this was only, it's not really that kind of like fear of strangers, so that kind of making strange, but this was just about like a scary thing, jumping at the
Hey
sight of
Marge, do you
something.
want to see my new hockey mask and chainsaw?
Exactly. We're talking terrifying in the dark, yeah, over the bed sort of scary thing. So that's exactly it. So they saw that there was no difference there, but they did see that the content of the microbiome at 1 year was associated with the difference in the size of the amygdala that we know is related to the
What?
part of the brain. Yeah, it's amazing that processes threat. So they're thinking that there's something, that there could be a connection between the way that children's microbiomes develop and then how they ultimately might end up sort of maybe having anxiety, or they might be more inclined to suffer from different disorders as they get older. If they're not able to, like, it's okay to be frightened of things. We need to be, children need to be, but they need to be able to also pull it back and go, okay, that's only a mask, and kind of tame it back down and keep it under control. And the harder that is, the greater your fear is, the harder that is, there could be an increased chance of different things like anxiety when they get older. So I mean, it's so
It's
new as
yeah.
a field. Like, who knows exactly where this is going? But it is, like, it's published in Nature Communications. It's extremely well done. The work is outstanding. It's just fascinating to think how much we don't know about microbiomes and the development of people.
It is a pretty incredible study. I mean, 30 people is not an enormous amount. We should bear that in mind because, essentially what we're if we looked at this at face value, we're saying that, the bacteria in your gut help you, regulate your fear. That's a pretty big claim, but very exciting work. Shane, our third story has to do with night vision.
Yeah, if you want to see at night, you need an eye that can detect infrared light. Our eyes can't really do that. So the reason you'd look for infrared light is that things that are hot give off infrared light or radiation, and so you can see things at night when the sun's not there. And that's what night vision goggles do. They convert infrared light into an electrical signal, and that's translated into a visual display. But it's very noisy, and so you need an awful lot of infrastructure in the helmet for you to see the infrared light. And so some scientists have looked at a different technology. They have looked at using thin films of something called gallium arsenide, which is a semiconductor. And using lasers, they're able to actually change the light from, yes, lasers indeed, change the light from infrared to visible. So what the laser does is actually changes the energy of the light, of the infrared light, into the energy associated with visible light. And that's pretty cool to be able to do that. It's very, very trendy.
Is it sort of like dropping music down a pitch?
That's exactly it. That's exactly it. It's like bringing things down a couple of keys. That's a really good analogy. So what the benefits of this would be that you'd have a very thin layer of this gallium arsenide on regular glasses. You'd have laser pointers that are shooting across the surface of the thin film, and that allows the conversion from the invisible light to the visible. And all that would need is a small battery to power it. So hypothetically, somebody wearing regular glasses like my own with this add-on would be able to see at night in the way that we see soldiers doing on those films.
Or like those nighttime documentaries where you get to see what badgers get up to at night.
But if we were able to imagine, like, what would that mean in terms of going around at night? Would we need so much artificial light if we were all able to wear these night vision goggles? There could be huge implications for the way we'd live and operate. Imagine driving at night with these glasses on. Be pretty cool.
But wouldn't you bump into things? Because the only things you can see are the things that are giving off radiation. Like a wall doesn't give off radiation.
Yes, it does.
What?
Yeah, because like the stone heats up during the day and will radiate then over the night. So
okay, fine. Yeah. All right. We're getting an argument about physics with a physicist. Finally, our final story is, it's okay to marry your cousin, Susan.
Yeah, I'm sure everyone's dying to hear this. We're finally okay to do it. So like this comes from work that is based around these websites called, like, there's one called MyHeritage where you can send in your DNA and you can kind of figure out your family tree. And so the person, although that, you know, that's a great, interesting thing to do, and there's a great curiosity there, but it's actually been used now for scientific applications. So the person who's working on developing this database has now used this to understand the transmission of genetic, cultural, economic, and socio-demographic factors through the decades. It's really huge. They've looked at 86 million individual DNA profiles and then figured out family trees. And so while there's loads of different things in this paper that they talk about, it's published this week in Science, they're looking, I suppose, one of the really interesting things is the transmission of genetic information. And genetic diseases, which is about marrying your cousins, of course. So before the 1950s, people on average were married to their fourth cousin. So that's very interesting. And a large factor in this was that people generally stayed where they were and they married someone within like a 10 kilometer radius. Now, we all know from COVID, that's not that far. That's very local. So no, and the other thing that this paper shows, research shows, that a lot of families kept wealth and power within a family. So they didn't want people marrying outside the family in order to keep all that close by. But then in the 50s, things changed. The increased ability to travel, women having more of a say in who they married. So that was great. Smaller family sizes meant that there were fewer cousins to marry, believe it or not. And then it also became socially unpopular. And of course, it became unpopular because of what we know around the harm or the risk associated with it. So first cousins can share 12.5% of DNA. And then, so think about if one set of your genes, you know, are damaged or leave you susceptible to disease, then let's say from your mom, and then your dad's genes, if they're totally different, then they can offer protection against said disease. And then children born from first cousins are twice as likely to have birth defects than those that are not. So the problem is, so, you know, you have a risk there. The problem is then if the next generation, and this is really what this study shows, is like marrying your cousins is a risk in terms of, you know, narrowing the genetic diversity. But if your cousins, like if your children, then if you marry your cousin and you have a child and that child marries their cousin, all of a sudden the amount of similar DNA increases and then the risk gets much higher of things. So it's shown that, you know, you really need to, perhaps the risk is low enough if you're marrying one set of cousins, but then you can't keep that going generation after generation. Interestingly, in America, pretty much across the board, they're seventh cousins of one another. People who are married, yeah, and have children. But by that stage, the significance in the DNA is so great that it's not damaging. And actually across Europe, it's the 12th, we're around 10th, 12th cousins. So it's interesting. So just be careful. But,
does
you know,
does it say what it is in Ireland?
No, it doesn't go to that specific specificity, I'm afraid. But we do.
Know.
I mean, we know that that's close.
We all know.
You know, my sister-in-law's French, so she's brought a wonderful, you know, array of different genes, excellent, Serbian and all sorts into the family. So yeah, we're getting there.
We're good. Forget about you guys. Marian Irish, we're fine. Excellent. Good to hear. Excellent work, Dr. Susan Kelleher from DCU and from UCD. Dr. Shane Bergen, thanks very much for joining us. Now, it's probably about 50 years old, the fortune-telling fish. You know the one that you get in the Christmas cracker? It's a piece of red plastic and you hold it in your hand. And the way it folds up tells you something about your future. It's known to have ruined many family Christmases by interpreting the future in the wrong way. But this idea of a self-folding material has come on leaps and bounds in the past 50 or 60 years. Joining us now to talk to us about self-forming materials is Scarlett Tibbetts. He's a co-director and founder of the Self-Assembly Lab housed at MIT's International Design Center. He's written a book called Things Fall Together, a guide to the new materials revolution. And some of the things he is doing will blow your mind. Welcome to the program, Scarlett. How are you?
Yeah, thanks so much. Pleasure to be here.
Give us an introduction to these self-forming so-called 4D materials. What sort of forces are at play and how does it work?
Yeah, sure. So, you know, every material is going to be active in some way. And most of engineering has been trying to stop that happen. You know, we don't often want our materials to be moving. We try to make them stable and static and homogeneous and, you know, kind of repeatable. And what we're trying to do is tap into the natural properties of materials that are highly active. You could take wood, for example. We know that wood curls and swells with moisture. Metals often will expand or contract with temperature. Polymers could be all sorts of different things, you know, different forms of light or temperature or moisture. And so you can use abundant energy sources in the environment, temperature, moisture, light, pressure, wind, waves, sun, whatever it is. And we can link those up with material properties. Any material you can think of, whether those are, you know, cutting edge new materials, or often in our lab, we use everyday materials, wood, plastic, metal, foam, rubber, you know, you name it. You look at those material properties, you link it up with an activation energy in the environment or in the application. But the key is that we often use different forms of fabrication. So, you know, printing or lamination or industrial knitting or weaving, the forms of fabrication can deposit those material properties in 2D and 3D structures. So you have essentially like a code, almost like DNA or almost like zeros and ones in the material. You have that information encoded in it. So then it can transform, change shape, change property based on that activation energy.
It's that sort of lack of consistency that we see in natural materials that you're sort of hijacking to make these things, right? So that you have an extra bit of metal here, so it contracts a little bit more quickly, or this is thinner, so it bends more easily. And as a result, you've lots of different shapes possible.
Yeah, so the trick is, how do you make it repeatable, precise, potentially predictable, or at least functional and high performing or useful in some way? You know, lots of materials move and transform. And as I was saying before, we're trying to fight that often. You know, like a deck on the outside of a house is going to expand and contract, or moisture may cause wood in the house or temperature in an engine or to move. And that often leads to failure. And that's why we tend to try to stop that from happening. But there is this huge open opportunity where we could tap into this natural active behaviors of materials if we can understand why it works and really collaborate with the medium. So by using these different forms of fabrication, you can then encode behaviors and agency through these patterns of instructions in the material property so that your clothing becomes breathable and adapts to your body temperature. Or as the environment outside gets hotter or cooler, or the moisture changes, or it's rainy or sunny, your clothing could be adapting on the fly to create the perfect level of comfort if we can tap into the material properties being active and transforming. We could create breathability or insulation zones that morph going thicker or thinner. You can use that active nature in a productive way. Typically, it's seen as a kind of destructive or chaotic thing. And so we're sort of turning the corner there.
Yeah. When we think of bulging due to moisture or heat, it seems uncontrolled, a mistake, and unpredictable. And so you're trying to remove that unpredictability to make the shapes and materials and responsiveness exactly the way you want it. Is that easier than it sounds?
Well, I don't know if it's easier, but we have many new tools and new understandings. So if you look at the history of wood, we've been talking a little bit about that. You know, go all the way back to like Japanese joinery or shipbuilding or alcohol barrels. There was master craftspeople that intimately understood the properties of wood to make super strong, highly precise, waterproof structures by using this swelling nature of wood. Then there was the Industrial Revolution. And now we see wood as like lumber, like 2x4s, you know, and we ignore this swelling nature, or we try to ignore it. And there's all this amazing grain and complexity, heterogeneous anisotropic properties of the wood that we pretend isn't there. And we're like, no, it's standard lumber. Nope. You know, if it has a knot, throw it out, you know, and we're ignoring all of the information and capabilities in the wood to pretend like it's this static thing when it's really not. But we have all of these new forms of fabrication that we can tap into the material properties and the craft-based knowledge that we used to have. Now with the industrial production, scalability, customization, because often, you know, it's difficult to build a home out of unique parts, you know, individual boulders or logs, you know, and twigs and stuff. It's hard. So we standardized it and we're like, we have bricks and we have 2x4s. Well, now you can have the customization and uniqueness and really tap into it at the same productivity and scale that we're used to, you know, since Industrial Revolution.
Talk to me then about the sort of projects you're working on with these self-forming and self-shaping materials.
So we look at a whole spectrum of things from materials. So we're interested in how materials change shape. You can have materials that morph to get new performance, new comfort, new breathability, new structural optimization, new aerodynamics, new whatever. They can actively tune themselves. But we're also interested in how materials can assemble themselves. You know, our lab looks at that whole spectrum. At the largest of scales, we have a project in the Maldives. It's with some collaborators called Invina. Maldivian team reached out to us. They knew our self-assembly, self-organization work. And so we're trying to apply that same level of thinking I was just talking about towards the challenges they're facing in terms of sea level rise and climate change. The idea being that islands and sandbars build themselves. More recently, we've used techniques like dredging, where we pump sand from the deep ocean, or, you know, building big walls and barriers to try to fight nature. And so we're trying to find a new solution where we actually collaborate with the force of nature to guide the self-organization of sand into useful areas. Like, how can you grow an existing island, or how can you grow a new island? By using the forces of the ocean and understanding or tweaking the bathymetry, basically placing geometries underwater, and you can promote self-organization of sand.
So what does that look like?
Yeah, so that looks like almost, think of a submarine meets a reef or something like that. Basically a geometry that we place underwater, a big bladder, almost like a ramp. And as waves and currents and tides of the ocean change, they interact with that geometry and new sand accumulates. And so we study that in our lab with wave tanks. And then we've done 2 field experiments, and we have a National Geographic grant now to do 2 more where we do this full scale in the Maldives, and we study it through satellite imagery, drones, physical measurements, and basically sand accumulates. And the goal is that you could grow a new island, or you could grow the beach on an island, or grow the beach on a coastline by tapping into these natural forces of the ocean. So that's like the largest of scales. And we have lots of projects on smaller and smaller scales too.
One of the projects I was really interested in was this self-assembling shoe.
We've done a bunch of work in the footwear space over the years. The one you're talking about is, we were trying to challenge how shoes are manufactured, because it's an interesting one. A shoe is very complex geometry. There's lots of components. You know, there's an outsole and a midsole, there's uppers, there's many different materials. They're glued, formed, stitched. It's pretty complex and labor intensive to make a shoe. There's a lot of waste that goes into it, lots of time, et cetera. And so what we showed is that with a single material, so basically a stretched textile, you stretch the textile and then you either print or bond or laminate or stitch a pattern onto that. So while it's stretched, you put this precise pattern onto it. And when you cut it out, it'll then jump and form itself into the shoe, almost like a jack in the box that turns into a shoe. And that could be a single material. The shoe forms itself into all the complex curvature. You don't need all of these extra materials and extra steps on assembly, you know, but we've done a lot of other projects on like morphing shoes for comfort, or new fabrication processes for how you can make shoes, or shoes that adapt for breathability and thermal performance, et cetera.
It's kind of hard to visualize what this looks like, but have a look on our Twitter page. We're at News Talk Science. You'll see a picture of it. We're not talking about a very simple shape. It's a very complex geometric shape that looks like a very well-designed, quirky Nike prototype shoe. Does this have soles built in as well, Skylar?
We did two different versions. One is the entire thing, so the upper and the outsole all is one. And then the other one is just the upper. And then that could be combined with a midsole, a traditional midsole, or an outsole if you wanted to.
It's really impressive. I mean, it shows that you can really engineer very precise and complex 3D shapes.
And it's really just trying to understand what is the geometry in 2D and how does that relate to the force of the textile, so that when it's released, it creates these complex shapes. So a circle will make like a hyperbolic paraboloid, which is like a saddle shape, for example. So different geometries will create different behaviors from 2D to 3D. And then you arrange those in patterns in order to get the full complex shape of the shoe.
That is very impressive. There's also some work you've been doing with BMW. Can you tell me a bit about that?
Yeah, so we were looking at the future of the car interior, and kind of the same notion. We're often trying to look at how is the quote unquote smart product done today. And typically that is add more components, add more devices, add more batteries, energy consumption. And the problem is then it often costs more, fails more often, requires more energy. So we're always up against this, like, well, why is that smart? Because the dumb thing is cheaper, lasts longer, and uses less energy. So isn't that smart? So we're kind of always thinking about that. And in the car interior, if you look at just the seat, for example, you know, it's the same game as the shoes. There's lots of materials, there's lots of mechanisms, lots of assembly required. It's a really complex thing. You know, you have cushions and structure, you have a lumbar support and massage features and heaters and all these kind of things. So anyway, we developed this single composite, basically like a future foam, if you think about it like that, that can morph. So if you sit in it, it can then morph around your body. It can take the shape of your body or my body. It can change stiffness. So if you want it softer or harder, it can have massage features and lumbar support all in the same thing, potentially even like airbags, because essentially this is like a pneumatic soft robot foam. It's just one single mat. It's about a meter and a half by a meter, and it can morph and almost like dance and transform from one thing to another thing. And that was all done with this new printing process that we developed called rapid liquid printing, where we print into a tank of gel. It eliminates the effect of gravity. We can print complex internal chambers. And that was enabling this large material composite to be produced, and then that can be morphed, you know, into any shape. And so it's combining all these functions of the chair into one material system.
When you say printing in gel, are you talking about 3D printing?
Yeah, exactly.
I see. So when you're 3D printing in, you know, it, not in zero gravity or something like it, you need a bit of time for this thing to solidify or gain its structure before it can come out. So that's why you have it in sort of a zero G environment in the gel. Is that the idea?
Yeah, typical 3D printing, you build layer by layer, and you're always fighting the effect of gravity. So you have to build support materials. You have to print those, which end up getting wasted and thrown out, and takes a lot of time to remove them. It takes a lot of time to print them. The higher you go in Z, the longer it is, the less efficient it is. So there's a lot of problems in like traditional 3D printing, just trying to build volumes in space because of gravity. So we print into a vat of gel, like think of Jell-O essentially. It's not that, but it's something like that. And when you draw in three dimensions, there is no effect of gravity. So it's just suspended. So it's like 3D calligraphy. You can draw, you can change speeds, change line weights, and then you pull it out of the gel and it's a solid object. You wash it with water. You can reuse the gel. You can print over and over and over again. So it makes it much, much faster. We can print meter scale objects, so you can do super large things. And then we've also, because of this, it's basically a liquid dispensing system. We can print with industrial materials like, you know, medical grade silicone, for example, which you typically can't do in traditional 3D printing because it needs to be a very special material that can be either sintered or laser cured or, you know, hot melted. So the printing process in traditional printing limits the materials. In ours, we can do a really wide range of like rubbers, plastics, foams, etc.
So some of the work you're looking at allows materials to adapt to their environment to make them more efficient or more streamlined, work better in terms of aerodynamics. Can you talk to me a little bit about that work and how that might improve efficiency?
In some of the high performance settings, like think of planes, for example, or cars, oftentimes you'll need electromechanical or hydraulic or pneumatic systems. You know, think of the flaps on a plane. And so we did this project with Airbus that I think is a good example here, where at the top of the engine, there's this air inlet and that causes drag. It reduces efficiency, but it needs to bring in cool air to cool down the engine. So what they were typically going to do is add an electromechanical or hydraulic or pneumatic flap to open and close that. But that also reduces efficiency because now you've added components, added weight, added potential failure, et cetera. So you've solved an efficiency problem with an efficiency problem. So what we did was develop this carbon fiber component, single component of carbon fiber that can open and close based on pressure differential. So depending on how fast or how slow the plane's flying, you have this pressure differential and the carbon fiber flap can open and close to control the airflow. So single material that then has the capability to modify that and then ultimately increase performance, reduce weight, et cetera. There's a lot of examples like that. We did this wing for a supercar that can morph to change the aerodynamics, like the back rear spoiler. And so there's many performance examples where the static component, now we're starting to see, can be active and can tune itself to increase the performance depending on, you know, how the person's driving or how you're flying or what the environment is around you, whether it's wet or dry or et cetera.
When are we likely to see this sort of idea, these sort of materials in the products around us to deliver, you know, lower carbon footprints, more efficiency, or designs that wouldn't ordinarily be possible because of the way these materials shape themselves?
Yeah, it's always a hard question, like when will they hit the market? Because in a way, you know, like we're a research lab. And so our main goal is to go from impossible to possible. Like that's our charge. And to push the boundaries of what's possible every day, like ask the questions, why isn't this possible? Or what if this happened? You know, and so we're really focused on that. But almost every one of these projects, you know, like I've talked about, is a collaboration with some company, and industry leading teams, you know, can go from possible to scalable. And so we often work with them. And then each one of them has their different timeline. So, it, you know, it's difficult to say how soon we hope fairly soon. And sometimes we then translate these on our own. So the liquid printing process, for example, we spun that out into a company so that we could scale it ourselves. Other times we work with partners. But I think you're already seeing that shift. Like if you look at apparel or footwear, there's the smart jacket, the smart clothes, the smart shoe, the smart whatever. The problem is that, right, like Nike did the self-lacing shoes. So now you need to like plug in your shoes at night, you know, or the jackets have like little battery packs and heaters. And that's the super near term. Like that's already happening. But what we're talking about is after that, we will realize that you don't need the batteries and the motors and the mechanisms. We'll embed it directly in the fiber of the textile. And then we will have much more elegant solutions that are highly active and lifelike, but won't have these bulky components and devices. And so that, you know, is the next generation of them.
And so someday soon, you're saying we might have clothing that will give us heat when we're cold and make us cold when we're hot?
Yeah, exactly. Or you can imagine, you know, you're outside, it's super hot out, you go inside, it's air conditioning, or it's super cold out in winter and you go inside, it's really warm with the heater, or you go on a run and you're kind of cold, then your body heats up. Like there's all these really dynamic swings that happen. And the only thing we have is layering. You know, there's really nothing else. It's just like add more, take more off. And so we're much more interested in that the clothing can adapt, like the thickness and the insulation value can morph as you need it, or the porosity and breathability can morph as you need it, or even the shape of it. I mean, our bodies are moving all the time. Think about going on a plane and then landing, often your ankles and legs are swelling, et cetera. Like the comfort and fit could also be morphing with our bodies.
And just finally, you know, the variability of these properties, I'm sort of imagining that it's plus or minus 5%, but are there materials out there that can dramatically change when exposed to different light, different temperature, that would really make a night and day comparison in the right environment?
Yeah, you know, some of our materials are like 150% swelling or much more. You can get really, really active things. I mean, think about wood, like roots of a tree can move houses, like literally move, you know, or they'll use swelling wood sometimes to shear stone, rock in quarries, etc. Like there can be extreme forces in active materials, you know, and similarly, you can get extreme transformations. So both force and geometric transformation can be, you know, really, really significant. But there's also other ones that are much more subtle. And so every material sometimes are fast, sometimes slow, have high force, have low force, sometimes repeatable, sometimes not. And so you're looking at what is the material and what's the application to try to dial those two in so they work well together.
Well, I highly recommend you check out our Twitter page. We'll see some photographs of what we're talking about, some really cool ideas of self shaping and self-molding materials. The book is called Things Fall Together, A Guide to the New Materials Revolution. Scarlett Tibbetts, thanks very much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks so much. Really a pleasure.
So as I say, check out the Twitter page at Newstalk Science to see some of the really cool ideas that Skylar Tibbetts, who's very excellently named, has put together. Producer Aidan McKelvey joins me. Have you ever met anyone with a better name than that, Aidan?
Not many. I try to choose our guests based more on their name than their science. So I feel like this is my greatest achievement.
I once worked with someone called Hans Wander.
That's a good name. No, you didn't.
I did, I swear. And then worked in Siemens. No joke. It's a true story. And then I met someone called Polly Parrott as well.
That's also brilliant. I knew my best Australian one is girl. I knew someone whose uncle's name was Justin Case.
Nice.
Which is pretty good as well.
Like, I think I'm pretty sure if my surname was Case, that's what I call my son.
Yeah, it's a worry, isn't it? Making your son's entire life a joke. Is it worth it? Possibly. It's a good joke.
Yeah. It's like that the boy named Sue song, isn't it? Great tune.
Indeed.
Right. It's time to look back at some of your comments from last week. Oh, by the way, Aidan, I got my job yesterday.
Ah, congratulations. Yeah, that's brilliant.
Just about made the cut age wise.
Yeah, so you're gonna be licking faces in what, 7 days?
A month.
Walking around and licking people's faces.
A month. So, dear listener, it's sweet that Aidan went along with this, but this is a lie. I got my job 2 weeks ago. I'm just saying I got it now because it makes me sound young. I'm going to let you podcast listeners in. This is a trick. So if you're getting your job now, wait for 2 weeks and then post it saying, just got my job. And people think you're really young. So that's what I've been doing. I'm going to post it next week on Twitter. I just got my job. So efficient at the Aviva. Blah, blah, blah. You know.
People will be really like, wow, is he really 28?
Yeah,
I thought he was on the radio
He knows a lot for someone who's only he's 13 years old. Yeah, it was grand. I mean, you know, nothing to report.
Yeah. But you're feeling good.
Well, that was a good talking point. I'm glad we went through that.
You're feeling optimistic. That's good.
Yeah, well, you know. Well, I've only got a couple of weeks to go and then I'm clear, which is good.
Well, I'm like 14, so I haven't gotten my mind yet at all. I haven't even registered. That's how young I am.
Yeah. It would be illegal for them to vaccinate you without your parents' permission.
Exactly.
All right, I got to go pick up the kids. So let's go through some of these comments from last week. So we were talking about mammals and why mammals don't lay eggs. Someone says, does a mammal not simply just suckle its young? I guess, yeah.
I think he's saying, is that not the definition of a mammal?
I don't think it is. No, I don't think so. No, I think there's other things going on. I can't refute it right now because I've had two glasses of rosé. But I think there's more than that because the person who wrote a book about mammals, the person who wrote the book about mammals didn't just say, oh yeah, it's just an animal that suckles its young. There's more to it.
She said it was down to a bone, wasn't it? Just like one jawbone or something.
That's right, yeah. Like the weird way we classify animals. We also talked about hypothermia and the science of it and the weird history of it. Someone says, hi, News Talk. The C-section on pregnant women was perfected on women prisoners in the camps. It's reference to the experiments the Nazis did, just basically seeing what hypothermia does to the body and what sort of extremes humans could be taken to. Horrible experiments. The validity of the science sort of question as to whether or not it was ethical to take anything from the results. But the C-section on pregnant women was perfected on women prisoners in the camps. I mean, that's horrific.
Yeah. It's really horrific. And it's such an,
you just worry ethical. What happened there. Yeah.
An ethical quagmire, like when you have that knowledge, you know, you can't bring those people back or change what happened to them. You use it? Should you not use it? It's something I remember. I think the first time I ever heard of that is it came up in my philosophy degree because it's just one of those sort of, it's unanswerable because it just feels so wrong to use it. But then do you also like let someone die by not using this knowledge that has been gained? It's a difficult one. I'm glad I don't have to answer it.
Yeah, I didn't know that. Wow. James has randomly texted in Lolo Ball, which I suppose is fun. That's an and finally text. I don't know what. Do you know what he's responding to, Lolo Ball?
I have no idea what he's responding to, but do you remember Lolo Balls? Remember what they were?
Yeah.
They were a lot of fun.
they were. It's weird that they didn't last. It seems like they should have been something that does last because we had like pogo sticks were shit. Like every like an old fashioned pogo stick is very difficult to move on, but a Lolo ball was they were quite well made, except when you left them out in the summer on a rainy day or a hot day and it expanded too much and you couldn't fit the plastic rim around them, and then they just ended up being like sort of crappy footballs that the dog chewed.
Yeah. One of my first memories of them actually is seeing a picture of Saturn and being like, why is that planet shaped like a Lolo ball?
Ha! There you go. Science right there. Aidan McKelvey, thank you very much. Simon Keane, Steve Dunn, Garrett Mahol. Steve McClune was on sound. We'll be back with more Future Proof in your podcast feed on Tuesday. In the meantime, stay curious.